Hello, and welcome to The Quantum Leap. Coming up, something of an arts-science special. We have an unusual exhibition of scientific glassware, a new book on creativity and intuition in art and science, and details of a speed dating event to match artists and scientists working together, plus our autumn weather and the winter constellations in the skies above. But we begin with malaria. It's a disease that kills over a million people every year. Most of them are children. Now, the World Health Organization recently announced that it wants the pesticide DDT to be widely sprayed in homes, in particular across sub-Saharan Africa. And this is in a bid to control the mosquitoes that carry the malaria parasite. Now, the use of DDT has been strictly controlled and in certain cases even banned for some 30 years. And that's because of concerns about its impact on the environment and on health. It can, for instance, cause certain cancers, and if it's sprayed on crops, it can accumulate in the food chain, and birds are particularly vulnerable, and that's because DDT can make their eggs brittle. And in the 1960s and 1970s, older listeners may remember that a number of species actually became endangered as a result. So why is the WHO recommending DDT's use again? Well, joining me now is Dr. Nancy Gallagher. She's on the phone from the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin, where she's Director of Travel Health, and she's in the Department of Tropical Medicine there. Nancy Gallagher, why is DDT back in favour?
Well, really, it's back in favour because, number one, the mosquito populations are in many countries are getting out of hand, and unfortunately, malaria is very much on the increase in susceptible areas, and in particular, sub-Saharan Africa, where it accounts for a significant number of deaths, particularly, as you said in your introduction, in children. So they've decided that they will use DDT again, but in a very specific way. This is not just blasting DDT on all and sundry. That's very important to say. It's a well-managed indoor residual spraying program.
So what would be different now about the way it will be used as against how it would have been used, say, 30 years ago?
Well, what they propose to do with it is to use it indoors, as the term implies. And it's a very long-lasting, long-acting spray. And you spray the indoor surfaces, such as walls, ceilings and floors of the dwelling. And it acts for a long time. Any mosquito that lands on this ends up dead. So you're not using it outdoors at all. So there's no danger of environmental accumulation of DDT.
Can I just ask you there? I mean, I would have thought that people are likely to be unhappy about having a chemical like this in their homes. And I understand, just reading some of the news reports on the web, that the decision is already proving to be controversial, and some of the WHO experts have actually apparently resigned over this.
Well, it's not apparent in the WHO's publications as such. They feel that a lot of research they have put into this really does not indicate that DDT poses more of a threat to either human life or the environment if it's managed carefully, if it's done indoors only. The fact is that people are dying from malaria, and it has been shown in countries who've reintroduced these spraying programs that the number of deaths from malaria drops dramatically. So it's a trade-off in some terms. But DDT is a very emotive subject, and I think this is one of the issues with it.
So certainly the environment concerns, I think, surfaced in particular in Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring back in the early 1960s, which kind of launched
the
modern environmental
1960s.
Movement. Indeed.
And they're not talking about using DDT as it was used then. They're talking about this indoor residual spraying. So it's a different approach. And according to WHO, they've done the research and they can't find any serious problems. And this has happened previously with other chemicals, such as the insect repellent DEET, where, you know, there was some concerns about it, and then when they looked at it again, they were able to relieve those concerns.
What about the use of screens and nets instead of or in combination with DDT and chemicals?
Yeah, when you're talking about malaria, the number of pillars you can put in place to separate humans from mosquitoes, the better your control is. And the less mosquitoes you have around, the less your risk is. The problem with mesh screens is they don't tend to work very well, and people aren't very good about maintaining them and so on. And they're getting better net treatments all the time. These are substances you can dip nets in and make them even better than nets on their own.
And recommendations for Irish people heading to malaria areas?
It really doesn't concern Irish people in terms of malaria prophylaxis for them. They're a completely different group you're talking about. The instructions for them is still, you know, insect repellent, mosquito nets, screens, and taking their prophylaxis and being aware that nothing is 100% foolproof and getting any unexplained fevers post-travel checked out.
Indeed. Nancy Gallagher, thank you. We've come now to the Natural History Museum in Merrion Street in Dublin, affectionately known to generations of Dubliners as the Dead Zoo, but it could also be known as the Glass Menagerie because it has a very unusual collection of crystal creatures. They're going on display in an exhibition that opens today and open to the public from tomorrow, Friday. And it coincides with a major international exhibition that's also taking place here, and that's to celebrate the life and work of the two Dresden glassmakers who produced these stunning crystal creatures, Rudolf and Leopold Blaschke. I'm with Nigel Monaghan, who's curator or keeper of the Natural History Museum, and Julia Sigwart, a zoologist from UCD, who's involved in organising the conference. Nigel, the first thing that will strike a lot of people is this is a traditional Natural History Museum, lots of stuffed animals, lots of pickled animals. Why would you have glass creatures?
Well, we've had these glass creatures for 120, 130 years. We've been buying them in instalments throughout the late Victorian period. And the reason the curators then bought glass models was there are a large number of animals that you simply can't present very effectively in a public exhibition, whether they're microscopic or whether they're made of soft tissues so that you can't skin them and stuff them in the traditional way that you might with mammals and birds.
For example?
Well, for example, you've got... When you think about a shellfish, most people see the shell on the beach. They rarely see the animal that actually lives and inhabits that shell throughout its life. And those animals are made of soft, rubbery tissues. If you think of things like snails in your garden, you see the snail shells, and most kids know what a snail shell is, but it's much more fascinating to see the whole animal and look at the snail. And what the father and son team, Leopold and Rudolf Blaschke, did was they modelled the whole animal in glass. In some cases, as in these examples, they used a real shell to show how the animal would live around the shell or protruding from the edge of the shell.
Because this case that we're standing here, which is just one in this exhibition, has limpets and abalone. I never knew what an abalone looked like. Is this what an abalone looks like? Julia, the marine biologist, can tell me it is, yes.
Yes, it is. Abalones are funny animals, and usually we see the underside of the shell, which is the beautiful blue pearly shell that's made into jewellery.
And you have some of them here.
Yeah.
They are stunning.
Aren't they beautiful?
Really beautiful.
But the outside of the shell and the snail itself is perhaps not so beautiful, but interesting in a very different way. Abalones are surrounded by a mane of tentacles, which they use to kind of sense the outside world. And they actually have quite a stupid defensive maneuver that if you upset them, they hunker down and they lift up their shell and they twist from side to side and splay out their tentacles to try to scare you.
It's like a huge hairy slug and it sits on top of a shell. Nigel, modern day, I mean, this was happening in the late 19th century where you had no other opportunities. What would a modern day museum be doing? Because presumably you're not buying precious glass creatures now, are you?
Well, unfortunately, nobody makes glass models with this level of skill anymore. What most museums do is they rely on wildlife photography footage, whether it's stills or moving footage, and that's what people see on their TV screens all the time. But you've got to remember, this is 150 years ago or thereabouts.
What is so special about these Blaschke glass creatures, and why is it that there's a conference happening here?
Well, basically today we're organising a conference to bring together all the information we can from the different people who have collections of these glass models. They're very valuable, potentially, although they're not available on the open market. They're nearly all owned by museums. They're very delicate, they're very brittle, and they're very intriguing because they're made up of lots of different materials. And we're trying to pool the general knowledge. We've been doing our own research into the materials they're made from and into how to look after them. And we have one of the largest collections in the world, so we're one of the key people in this equation of trying to extract the knowledge we can from this collection and then pool it in terms of long-term preservation.
Julia, what will the conference be about? Who's going to attend?
Well, the conference is basically about the Blaschkas and their importance both for art and for science. So it's interesting because there's never been any kind of organized academic meeting about the Blaschkas or about these kinds of scientific models before anywhere in the world. So this is, in a way, very experimental, the meeting, but we're very excited about it. And so the people who are coming range from conservators who are trying to fix and repair the objects, to natural history curators who have them in their care, to biologists, people interested in the history of science, artists, scientific illustrators. It's a wide range that goes across many different kinds of disciplines in art and science.
They really are a wonderful fusion, if that's the right word, yeah, for something in glass, fusion of art and science and craftwork. And some of the ones that you have on the exhibition here, there are blue dragons, I think. They're a kind of sea slug. They look like brooches. They're really like jewellery. What have we got here?
Well, the exhibition overall is trying to show you the glass animals in a context of their counterparts in nature and the biology of what kinds of animals they are, and especially why we needed to have glass ones historically, because some of them are quite ugly when they're dead. So we're a scientific museum, so the emphasis here is very much on the science rather than on the artistic side of it. But unfortunately, some of them have had rather tough lives when they've been held in other collections as well.
And so we have two octopuses. Octopi, is that the plural?
Octopuses.
Octopuses. One of them, beautiful glass thing, it's about 6 inches across, really lovely. And a very unfortunate example beside it that shows what can happen. The glass is fragile. This one is stuck together with sellotape.
Unfortunately, because all of these pieces are held in universities and museums that, like us, are in charge of scientific collections rather than art collections or collections of historical artifacts, they're often in the care of people who are not quite sure what the best way is to repair them. And so one of the things that we've learned is that it's very important only to seek expert guidance and people who are experts in glass and glass manufacture and glass conservation, trying to repair these models and make sure that they have a stable future.
And I know from talking to other people about this that there are other challenges, such as the pigments that were used and the way they were painted and treated and how they were glued together, and a whole range of challenges for conservators. Nigel, what in general is in the exhibition for the public who can come in and see this now?
There's over 300 pieces of Blaschka work throughout the museum, and they're there throughout the year, and they've been there for over a century. What we've done is we've taken on the ground floor of the museum 9 cases to show you examples of animals from other museums in Ireland, other university museums and collections, and also some of our own, to show you some of the background to the techniques that were used to make them, and also the conservation approach that we're using to understand better how to look after these things. So we're trying to highlight what there is as a total resource of these models in Ireland, which is something near 800 models.
And there are examples in this exhibit, in our temporary display, from NUI Galway, University College Cork, as well as Trinity College Dublin and University College Dublin. All of them have never been displayed to the public before.
That's it. It's the wonderful Crystal Creatures exhibition displaying the work of Leopold and Rudolf Blaschka, a veritable glass menagerie. It opens tomorrow, Friday, and it's open to the public, admission free, until the end of the year in Dublin's Natural History Museum. And my thanks to Nigel Monaghan, keeper of the museum, and to Julia Sigwart, who's organising the international conference from UCD.
You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Now, there's a lovely little colour brochure to accompany that exhibition, and thanks to the organisers, we have copies to give away to 20 lucky listeners. Details at the end of the programme. Now, staying with art and science, Seen Unseen is a new book by art historian Professor Martin Kemp from the University of Oxford. It's an exploration of how scientists and visual artists attempt to represent the world. It's a heavy hardback book. It's full of illustrations, and it covers a very broad canvas from the Renaissance to the Hubble Space Telescope. And with me in studio to discuss the book is a scientist turned artist, Cathy Fitzgerald, originally from New Zealand, but now based in Ireland. Cathy Fitzgerald, what is Martin Kemp's thesis? What is he saying?
Well, Martin Kemp is a historian, and he's looking at this topic, which is very broad, and his specialty would be the Renaissance area. But he does write about contemporary art practice, and he's most well known for writing columns in Nature about, I suppose, different influences that artists and scientists have had on them, each other.
And Nature is the weekly scientific journal.
That's right. And okay. I came across Martin Kemp's book when I was in art college, and that actually collected his articles from Nature, and he published that a few years ago. So it was very interesting for me trying to grapple with being an artist but having a very strong interest in science, particularly natural science.
Okay, and this new book, what is he saying?
This new book, he's really looking at not a chronological sort of examination of the two disciplines, but he's thinking about recurring themes, sort of, and he illustrates these with different people. Some of them are well known, like Leonardo, but other people who may be interested in taxonomy and people who have used the visual strategies to go into the unknown. And at times he would say visual practices have been very important in science and in art, and sometimes these go underground again, and that these sort of visual strategies are actually still in contemporary technologies. When we look at through electron microscopes, we're still using strategies that were in the Renaissance development of ideas of perspective.
So it's very much about how people visualise things.
And he is the head of the Centre for Visual Studies in Oxford. So he's actually looking not as an artist or as a scientist, but very much someone who's a historian of the visual culture, threading through both disciplines.
Can you give us any particular example that leaps out at you from the book?
There was an unknown person who I've never come across before. He talks about a ceramicist, I think it's from a person called Palissy from the 17th century, who was taking casts of living organisms. And in so doing so, he believed he was sort of co-creating with God. But there was such an interest in fossils. This was before the ideas of evolution. And he was actually finding fossils, and he was trying to make his own fossils. So there was this creative thing. And he was also someone who was very much against theory, and he wanted to experiment with animals in the process. So you could get the feeling of the dawning of somebody who wanted to start experimentally looking at evidence rather than just ideas.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a very broad canvas that he's given himself. He goes from the Renaissance right up to the modern day, from the development of perspective and the pinhole camera up to particle accelerators. Is this too broad a scope, or is it actually you need this to get to grips with what he's talking about?
He, in his introduction, he says there's very sharp jumps, and it's a book you dip in and out of. You wouldn't be able to read this one sitting.
Okay.
But certain chapters, like he talks about reductionism and holism, and I think they're very interesting for myself as an artist now, and you could really dip in and go quite deep. And I kept thinking that there would be quite a few artists who are interested in science, but also scientists who would get a lot from this book.
Okay. Is there anything new in what he's saying? Or is he drawing stuff together?
I think that the new thing is he's drawing things together. And I think him coming from an art historian's perspective is he's looking at it in a very deep way. And I am aware of other professors in America. I think Professor James Elkins is also looking at the history of visual culture. And they're sort of sidestepping just art history. And they are looking at sort of diagrams produced from science. So it seems to be a new developing field.
From the way you talk about dipping into it and going deep, I'm reading in this that you don't think it's a light read. This isn't for the popular.
No,
this isn't a coffee table book.
No,
does it border on the academic?
It does, and he is an academic, so that comes across. But I still think there's a lot of things that you can gain from his book, and I do think scientists would very much value it, particularly scientists who may be more into the natural soft scientists. They would be more using visual material in their work. He does touch on physics and astronomy as well, and the visual in that. But I do get the feeling that he's more comfortable with the natural science people who would have illustrated botanical works over the centuries and things like that.
So who is this book for, and who should read it?
Well, I'd be very happy to have it on my bookshelf. But I think it's for a very select but maybe growing audience of people interested in the crossover between art and science. And often scientists would say, well, what's the justification for the growing amount of art exhibitions about science? And I think he's coming up with a new sort of argument to say that we should be looking at the history of visual culture that threads its way through both disciplines, and not to get too hung up whether it's art or science, which is good for one or good for the other.
Or it can be both.
Yeah, it can be
both.
Okay, thank you. That's Seen Unseen by Martin Kemp, published in hardback by Oxford University Press, price £25 sterling. And thank you, Cathy Fitzgerald. Now, staying with art and science and the crossover, there's two upcoming events that may be of interest. First, a panel discussion about art and science this Saturday morning in the National Museum in Kildare Street in Dublin. And that's part of the Blashka Conference that we talked about earlier with the crystal creatures that's taking place over the next 2 days. We'll have details about that in the link from our own programme website. And coming up on Tuesday, October the 17th, an unusual speed dating event, again in Dublin, which aims to bring together artists and scientists for possible collaborations. It's organised by an art science initiative called SEED, and here I have to declare a personal interest, because I'm peripherally involved in SEED, and I know Cathy has taken part in events there as well too. And on the line to tell us about the event is SEED Administrator Eimear Bruin. This is her opportunity to give us a speed rundown on the speed dating. Eimear Bruin, tell us in a minute about your SEED speed dating event.
Speed dating is based on the idea of speed dating. But instead of having the males and female groups, we're going to have artists and scientists instead. And the idea is that everybody will come along. The event actually takes place on the 17th in the Odessa Club in Dublin. Everybody will come along there and make sure that they speak to everybody else in the room with the idea that some people could learn. Maybe some scientists might learn what artists are doing in relation to science and vice versa, and this might produce some collaborations between them. We were going to have the artists and scientists as different groups within the seed dating experience, but we think that a lot of scientists have artistic backgrounds and have artistic ideas, and a lot of artists have kind of scientific inclinations as well. So we're not going to segregate like that. We wanted to just leave it kind of open so people could meet others who work within the same discipline and the opposite one, and possibly work on some smaller or large-scale projects. It could be anything, really, and then they would be invited back to present at future salons.
Excellent. And a quick word about what SEED is?
SEED itself is an organisation, a Dublin-based organisation, which promotes the collaboration between art and science in general. Usually we do it in the form of monthly salons, performances, other events and workshops and things like that to show people that there are links there and kind of to bring up the more obvious and less obvious of those links.
Very good. And that's the SEED speed dating event for artists and scientists on Tuesday, October 17th in Dublin. And we'll put a link to that from our own programme website at rte.ie/radio1/quantum. Coming up, our occasional look at the science behind the weather and at the night sky. I'm going to be talking to meteorologist Evelyn Cusack from Met Éireann in studio with me, and on the line from NUI Maynooth, Emily Duffy, keen amateur astronomer and physics student. But first, a final reminder about our competition for an iPod Nano. Send us your thoughts about nanotechnology. And that's even if you know next to nothing about it, we'd like to know what you think. Less than 300 words, please, no essays, and to arrive by this Saturday, September the 30th, and you can send them by email to quantum@rte.ie. Now, time for our occasional look at the science behind the weather and at the heavens above. And joining me in studio is meteorologist Evelyn Cusack from Met Éireann. And on the line from NUI Maynooth is Emily Duffy, keen amateur astronomer and physics student. Evelyn, if I can come to you first, we had the autumn equinox last weekend. And it seems to me that the weather this last week has been autumnal, or am I imagining it?
Not really, Mary. The weather throughout the year in Ireland is influenced by the Atlantic Ocean. Our prevailing winds are between west and south, so our weather throughout the year comes in generally from the Atlantic. Obviously, the days are getting shorter now, so the days are getting a bit cooler. The peak temperatures of around are August, but in fact, August this year was a little bit cooler than normal, and that's because we had northerly winds. The weather over Ireland is entirely dependent on where the air masses come. As I said, it's predominantly from the Atlantic, but we can get it coming from the North Pole, from continental Europe and from the tropics. So winter or summer, it's entirely dependent on the air mass over Ireland.
And because we've less sunshine and presumably kind of less heat hitting us at this time of the year, which I think is because we're tilted, not that we're further
tilting
from the sun,
back,
but we're tilted away
yeah.
from it. Does that make it unstable, changeable at this time of the year?
It is unstable, but not any more so. I think we get more vigorous storms in the winter, all right, and due to the clash of cold polar air and warm tropical air, the extremes are felt more in winter. And I think in particular, if we have anticyclonic conditions, that's high clear air over Ireland. In winter, that gives our severe frost, minus 15 perhaps on the ground. But in the summer, that results in fine sunny conditions. So we want the Scandinavian high in the summer. We don't particularly want it in the winter.
Emily Duffy, if I can turn to you on the phone from Maynooth. Does the night sky actually change from summer to winter?
Yeah, it does a bit. What basically happens is that a set of constellations rises above the horizon on one side of the sky, and then correspondingly you lose a few constellations on the other side of the sky. So if you think of it as if the whole sky kind of shifts across. So a certain set of constellations kind of move above our head, and that's great for observing because you can see them really well. And then you get a new set of constellations rising up on one side above the horizon. An example, let's say, is a constellation Cassiopeia. It's a very distinctive W shape, literally looks like a giant W in the sky. And Cassiopeia, as winter goes on, moves right above our head, so it's very easy to see. It's a very good spot for observing. And then the other constellation, which is just a treasure trove that rises above the horizon, is Orion the Hunter.
I like Orion. It's one of my favourites. When will Orion start to come up above the horizon?
Well, it's starting to rise up now. If you wait sort of into November, December, Orion will be very clear in the sky, and it's a really good target. There's the Orion Nebula is in the constellation Orion. So if you find there are four stars which form a kind of an upright rectangle, and they're Orion's sort of head and shoulders and his legs. And then in the middle, there are three stars which are very close together. That's his belt. And then below those three stars, there are three kind of hazy stars and roughly upright. And the middle one of those isn't actually a star. It's the Orion Nebula. And it can be seen with the naked eye as a kind of a hazy patch in the sky. Very, very beautiful spot, you know.
Okay. So that's Cassiopeia and Orion, two of the winter constellations. Thank you very much. That's Emily Duffy. Evelyn Cusack, thank you. Just time to bring you some snippets of science news. Research published in this week's edition of the science journal Nature reveals why the 1918 Spanish flu virus was so deadly, because it seems it triggered an exaggerated immune response in people. And the same journal also brings news that tarantula spiders can secrete silk from their feet, partly helps them stick to surfaces when they're walking. And I also see a New Scientist news from a Swiss biotech company that may have discovered a way to eliminate allergies completely by distracting the person's immune system. And reports of a new British technique for diagnosing brain tumours without the need for a dangerous biopsy needle. That's it for this week. Just time to tell you about how to win one of the 20 brochures for the Crystal Creatures competition. We'll take the first 20 names out of the hat. The closing date is next Thursday, October the 5th. Send postcards to The Quantum Leap, RTE Radio, Donnybrook, Dublin 4, or email quantum@rte.ie and put Crystal Creatures in the subject line. That's it for this week. You'll find more information about the items in our programme on the programme website at rte.ie/radio1/quantum. Until next week, Slán tamall.